and it's just been a pile of rubble. And that was what Rumi had to cope with in his life. And that, to me, is, you know, his life was a healing of that disaster. I look at the major poets in my life, like Virgil, Dante, Wordsworth. They've all contemplated, or T.S. Eliot, they've all contemplated disaster like that. And their art, which is the art that really interests me, is a poetry that is a healing from disaster.
And that's where I feel like that's where the bravery of poetry really comes from, because when you live through or witness or know of these tragedies, and then having that wherewithal and the bravery to write about it, I think is kind of the kind of opens the floodgates for whatever comes next, and that healing we've been talking about.
I agree with that. I agree. When something like that happens, either you're crushed or else you have to summon up a strength to respond to that kind of catastrophe, which is beyond the strength that you would need for a normal life. And then if you tend to also to be creative, then you have a strong kind of creation. See, that's to me why Wordsworth's Prelude, he witnessed the French Revolution, which he believed in, and then he saw the massacres and the guillotine, and this so shocked him, he went into depression, and then recovered and wrote the Prelude, and eventually, after a few years, he added in what he couldn't have written about before, which was his horror at the killings. And where you take someone like Byron, who was a great poet, probably a more gifted poet in some ways, and his epic, Don Juan, isn't about anything like that. It's just a chatty poem. It doesn't have the substance because it's not built on the experience of catastrophe that makes for really great poetry.
Yeah, so Wordsworth speaks to a wise passiveness. Your books reference a Buddhist tradition of being mindful without doing. The doing is the looking. It is a simple doing, a sort of passiveness. Nor less I deem, Wordsworth tells us, that there are powers which of themselves our minds impress, that we can feed this mind of ours in a
right,
wide passiveness.
My wife has going to do she helps people by phone, and she needs the phone at 4, so I think I'd probably better get off now. But I really enjoyed this. I really enjoyed the part when we got off the air. That was great.
Well, thank you, Peter Dale Scott. We really appreciate you taking the time to call in and talk about so many important world events and how poetry can kind of unlock the key to those, and not only help the writer but to understand better, but also the reader. I think poetry is that kind of accessible form, and I'm enjoying reading your work, and I look forward to reading more.
And to be continued.
To be continued. You're welcome. Anytime.
This is about community. This is about people coming together. It's about free speech. Yeah, using these vehicles of the internet, we can reach around the world, and people can listen to it. So this is a whole step forward. It's about Peter. It's called Doing More Together Than Any of Us Can Do on Our Own.
Bye-bye, I'm going to say. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, Peter.
Take care, and thank you. Thank you, James Zealous, for being in contact with Peter Dale Scott. I know that you've long read his work and got to meet him and invite him on to the Common Thread Collective. I think it was a fantastic, an esteemed addition to today's episode.
Well, thank you for having us, Clover Val. It was my pleasure.
Yes, and I hope to see you back here, James Zealous, as a guest interviewer in the future, because you have so much brilliance to share yourself. So thank you for guiding that discussion with us with Professor Peter Dale Scott. He has his own website, peterdalescott.net, with lots of resources to his writings, not just poetry, but some even more hard-hitting, deeper political research, such as the deep state and the road to 9/11, a very well respected and received scholar, professor at UC Berkeley, former ambassador in Canada, and he was part of the he served with the United Nations as well. So very nice to have, very nice to bring that into today's show.
Let me take you higher.
Thank you, thank you. So let's play a little music here.
Are you leaving?
Let's play a little music here and transition. And you're listening to the Common Thread Collective here on MutinyRadio.fm. And you can come down and join us at the corner of 21st and Florida Streets in San Francisco. Thank you for listening to the Common Thread Collective here on MutinyRadio.fm. The Common Thread Collective happens every Friday from 3 to 6 here, 21st in Florida. Hope you'll come through. Today we're giving a bon voyage to Dave as he heads off on his summer cross-country journey. But I'll be here most of the summer holding it down here. So please do come through. Bring some music, play what you got to play, bring some poetry, writing, say what you got to say, and your activism as well. So I'm Global Val, and I'm certainly happy to be here on Friday, June 10th, 2016. And we've got our friend, musician Bloodflower, out there sitting at the piano, and he's going to play us some music. So everybody kick back, relax, and enjoy for a few minutes of musical flavors from Bloodflower.
Thank you. not made empty. It is simple to die. It is hard to continue. For continuity is effort to be or not to be.
It is hard to continue. We're getting that microphone set up again for Blood Flower. And then, James, you can start from the beginning of your piece, just two lines before. Are you knocking it? What's going on here? What's going on? This is live radio, folks. This is part of the fun of the Common Thread Collective. I hope we moving forward with making sure that the host doesn't trip over the microphone line. Here we go. Ta-da.
It had stopped raining. The roads were clean and the dust had been washed from the trees. The earth was refreshed, and the frogs were loud in the pond. They were big, and their throats were swollen with pleasure. The grass was sparkling with tiny drops of water, and there was peace in the land after the heavy downpour. The cattle were soaking wet, but during the rain they never took shelter, and now they were contentedly gazing. Some boys were playing in the little stream the rain had made by the roadside. They're naked. It's good to see their shining bodies and their bright eyes. They were having the time of their life, and how happy they were. Nothing else mattered. And they smiled out of joy as one said something to them, though they couldn't understand a word. The sun was coming out, and the shadows were deep. Possessions make the mind weary. Acquisition, whether of knowledge, of property, of virtue, makes for insensitivity. The nature of the mind is to acquire, to absorb, is it not? Or rather, the pattern it created for itself is one of gathering in. And in that very activity, the mind is preparing its own weariness, boredom, interest. Curiosity is the beginning of acquisition, which soon becomes boredom. And the urge to be free from boredom is another form of possession. So the mind goes from boredom to interest to boredom again till it is utterly weary. And these successive waves of interest and weariness are regarded as existence. A person asks, how is one to be free from acquiring without further acquisition? Only by allowing the truth of the whole process of acquisition to be experienced, and not by trying to be non-acquisitive. Detached. To be non-acquisitive is another form of acquisition, which soon becomes wearisome. The difficulty, if one may use that word, lies not in the verbal understanding of what has been said, but in experiencing the false as the false. To see the truth in the false is the beginning of wisdom. The difficulty is for the mind to be still. For the mind is always worried. It is always after something, acquiring or denying, searching and finding. The mind is never still. It is in continuous movement. The past, overshadowing the present, makes its own future. It is a movement in time. hardly ever an interval between thoughts. One thought follows another without a pause. The mind is ever making itself sharp, and so wearing itself out. If a pencil is being sharpened all the time, soon there will be nothing left of it. Similarly, the mind uses itself constantly and is exhausted. The mind is always afraid of coming to an end. But living is ending from day to day. It is the dying to all acquisition, to memories, to experiences, to the past. How can there be living if there is experience? Experience is knowledge, memory. And is memory the state of experiencing? In the state of experiencing, is there memory as the experiencer? The purgation of the mind is living, is creation. Beauty is in experiencing, not in experience. For experience is ever of the past, and the past is not the experiencing. It is not the living. The purgation of the mind is tranquility of the heart. J. Krishnamurti.
Dancing sideways down the ribbon of time. Dancing sideways down the ribbon of time. The path ahead lit
by the echo.
By the echo behind.
Clearing the mind, the past filling the heart.
The past shakes hands with the future through the now. Through the now. Getting excited. Hey, James, that was so beautiful. And we got another James.
Thanks for reading J. Krishnamurti.
Oh, my goodness.
And
so
thanks,
beautiful.
Bloodflower, for playing. And Bloodflower's getting ready for the next voice.
Hey, Bloodflower, can you give me something in a natural minor key, please?
There you go, James.
$5?
And the change. Just some change. You have to change.
Very
change
funny, Bloodflower.
He's a funny guy.
Look at him up there.
All right.
Somebody's got to do it. Huh?
We're having fun here. I was born ready.
Waiting on you.
Okay, yeah. Well, you're going to wait a little longer with that attitude.
Don't give me any ideas. All right. Hello, folks. My name is James Conrad. And I have my book here, Zurdo Cleans House, which is available on Amazon.com. And story continues. Just to kind of put anyone who's just tuning in now who hasn't been following the series, Zurdo has been wrongfully convicted of murder and child molestation. He's done time in San Quentin prison. He's gotten out because he was found innocent. There was no way he could have committed the crime, since the crime was committed by a left-handed man. And he, Lorenzo Carlos Ruiz, being nicknamed Zurdo, he unfortunately ended up getting diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And now he has avenged himself. But now there's going to be a little bit of a side trip in episode 71. And today we're getting a double feature. We're doing episode 71 and 72 of Zurdo Cleans House. Well, I just wanted to make up for the deprivation I gave you, Richard. So here, the story continues with episode 71 of Zurdo Cleans House. Hector Morales looked at his computer screen with a concerned frown as he read an online article about the death of Judge Malcolm Connors, shivering a little as he read that the crime took place at the Campbell Inn, where his friend Casey Keene asked him to rent a room for him. When he asked Casey why, Casey told him, "It's a long story, too complicated to explain." Hector knew there was something fishy about the whole business. Chewing his lip as he tingled with curiosity, he opened a new browser tab and punched Kendall Reichert's name into a search engine. Beneath the reports of his death, he saw an article dating from March the 1st, 2000, with the headline, "Ruiz Guilty of Murder, Child Abuse." After clicking the link, he skimmed the text of the article, noticing not only Judge Reichert's name, not only Kendall Reichert's name, but those of Michael Kerr, Judge Malcolm Connors, and Gregory Keene, and his friend Casey, the adopted son of Gregory Keene. "Hmm," said Hector, wrinkling his brow with concentration as he remembered that Gregory Keene, Michael Kerr, Kendall Reichert, and Judge Malcolm Connors had all died in fiery explosions not long ago, which he confirmed by performing a web search on each in different browser tabs. Just then, his cell phone rang. He took it out of his pocket and looked at the view screen with a frown, for he did not recognize the number but answered the call nonetheless. "Hello," he said. "Is this Hector Morales?" "This is Hector," he said. "Who's speaking?" "This is Raymond Jeffries, and I'm with the Santa Clara County Sheriff's Department. I'm calling in regard to the bombing at the Campbell Inn that happened just a few days ago on the 14th. You were on the list of tenants that the front desk clerk gave to me, so I just wanted to get in touch and ask if you saw anything unusual that night." "Funny you should mention that," said Hector with a quick, subtle twitch of surprise. "I was actually thinking of talking to you." "Okay," said Deputy Jeffries. "Did you want to come and meet me over at the station on Younger?" "Yes," said Hector. "I can come there right now." "Okay, fantastic," said Deputy Jeffries. "See you then." Hector drove to the sheriff's office and saw Deputy Jeffries waiting for him outside in front. As soon as the two men met, they went inside the building, walked down the hall to a private office. After Deputy Jeffries closed the door behind them, they sat down across from each other at the table while Jeffries clicked on a tape recorder. "So what was the nature of your business at the Campbell Inn?" asked Jeffries, sliding his reading glasses up on the bridge of his nose and picking up the pen he had set by the notebook in front of him. "My friend Casey asked me to rent a room for him there and put it in my name," said Hector. "He said that his friend needed to take care of some business. I asked him what it was, and he said that he couldn't say it was private. He gave me the money for the room plus $1,000, so I told him, 'Okay, if it's that important to you, I'll do it.' So I rented the room, and I thought nothing of it until I heard about the car bombing." "So you suspect that Casey Keene had something to do with it?" asked Deputy Jeffries. "Yeah," said Hector. "I just put two and two together. Then I looked up Judge Connors on the internet and saw that he was the judge in a trial where Casey was a witness, like back in 2000. And the other guy who got blown up by the shark tank, Kendall Reichert? Yeah, him. I read that he was the prosecutor at the trial, and Casey's stepfather, who died in that house fire they said was an accident, and that other guy who burned to death, they were witnesses. I thought there was something strange about it all, and when I saw the names in the article from 2000 about it, I figured that just might have something to do with what happened at the Campbell Inn. So you think that Casey murdered Judge Connors? I don't want to jump to conclusions, but I have a feeling he might have had something to do with it. Also, considering everything else, I don't think what happened to Michael Kerr, Casey's stepdad, was an accident." "Yeah, I can see that," said Deputy Jeffries with a thoughtful frown. He reached into his pocket, dug out his cell phone, and called George Sykes, an FBI agent who'd been assigned to the case. "Hey, George," he said, "it's Ray." "Yeah, good news. I think we might have a suspect." Tune in next week for episode 73 of Zurdo Cleans House, available on Amazon.com. Now, before I depart the stage, I just want to give our listeners out there some important information about Mutiny Radio. And basically, we are supported. Well, we're an independent station, and a lot of our support comes from various donors and from certain sponsors of ours, and also from listeners like yourself.
And monthly dues that we pay every month.
Yeah, we do have monthly
That's
dues.
That's mostly
that we
what we do.
And there are monthly dues from the various people who put in the time here. So there's numerous... well, here's a chance for you listeners to be a part of keeping Mutiny Radio able to bring you excellent programming such as, you know, Pam's Comedy Clubhouse, Pam's Happy Hour Open Mic, Labor and Love, Women's Magazine, and numerous other programs. To get involved, it's dead simple. Here's how it works. Just make out a money order for a dollar or more to Mutiny Radio and send that money order for a dollar or more made out to Mutiny Radio to the following address: Mutiny Radio, 2781 21st Street, San Francisco, California, 94110. Once again, that is Mutiny Radio, 2781 21st Street, San Francisco, California, 94110. We look forward to your support, and we hope to continue bringing you quality programming. Thanks a million. Yeah,
Bloodflower. Thanks so much. Thanks, James Conrad. Thanks, Bloodflower.
Yes. Another way to lend a hand is coming in and lending a hand. We'd be here every Friday from 3 to 6. It's the door is open. The arms are open. Open heart. And we're interested in getting this flow going of talk of what happening, pushing the envelope, social, cultural, personal, and political change. Here we be. And in fact, it's, hey, Val. Sarah, welcome back. This is your, Sarah, who's directly connected with this community, who's been out there in Greece and Turkey with the refugees. And here's Ahmed, too, who's become a kind of a regular guest, talking about these vital places, talking about what's happening there. We're trying to put this is the revolutionary message of peace, love, and understanding, and doing more together than any of us can do on our own. That's what we'll be about. So, Ahmed. Hey, Sarah. So good to see you. No, we got it.
That's all right. Yeah,
we got a mic for each one of you.
Yeah, we're just going to widen the base of that mic stand, and then I think it kind of push it up like a, there you go. I want to thank Tyler. Tyler's like our new intern here, and it's very helpful to have a set of hands on the microphone situation.
Oh,
this
yeah.
is a roll your own. We traditionally do kind of a roll your own here, but but it's much better to have folks on hand. Thanks, Tyler, so much. And yeah, welcome, Sarah. Welcome, Ahmed. Wow, talk about the front lines of social, cultural, and political change. We've got Sarah here, who's been attending to the refugee crisis in Greece and Turkey. And we've got Ahmed here, whose memoir, You Are Under Arrest for Masterminding the Egyptian Revolution. We are here on the cutting edge of cultural, social, and political change.
And Sarah, you there? You left some time ago, a few months ago, about 3 or 4 months ago, is it? For Lesbos and beyond.
I went in early January.
Early January. So you've been seeing some of the results of this upheavals. There have been Syria, people from all of people coming through, people drowning, people being dragged out of the water, as a river, if you will, a river of refugees coming from these countries. Libya and Egypt. Egypt seems a little more difficult because they're crossing these lines, but Ahmed, you were there, you grew up there, you're part of it. Well, how do you see Egypt connecting with this river of refugees, and how can we find that common thread? You two haven't seen each other before, but now we're getting on the same page.
I would like to say about this is actually a big warning, because under the current dictatorship in Egypt, which is a military dictatorship that achieved power through a coup d'etat in contradiction with American laws, in contradiction with international laws, so there should be sanctions against this regime. This regime is being aided, funded, and armed. And this regime is every day committing war crimes against its own people through air bombing of civilian houses, through assassinations, torture till death, through corruption, and a total destruction of the country. The country is breaking apart, and when it does, if this situation continues, this will be 4 times at least the problem we see now with Syria. This is going to be massively, seriously, a huge humanitarian disaster. that is not going to be touching only one area in the world. This will have ramifications that I believe could stir a huge change in the course of how humanity is now in a very negative way. Because imagine 100 million people fleeing from a war zone torn Egypt, where there is nowhere to go, because actually Egyptians live only in 5% of the Egyptian land where it's livable. So you have 100 million people in the Nile Valley, and that is very tight, and then when the disaster hits, they will have to go. There is no other place for them to stay. So this is what we are looking at. The current U.S. administration is arming this regime, is giving them cover, legal cover, media cover, etc. The Republicans, on the other hand, they want to have alliances with this kind of dictatorships in order to defeat what they call Islamic terrorism. While that terrorism that they call Islamic, which we never call Islamic, by the way, these are Islamists, and it's very different. Those terrorists that are using violence, that are attacking people in the Middle East and killing them most of all, are doing this why? Because of grievances, injustices, tyranny, corruption. When your house gets bombed by your government and people are dead, we can face this differently. Maybe I would face this with sadness, with grief, and I would try to combat this nonviolently. But someone else would go crazy, because you can't expect everybody to be sane when they lose their loved ones. And they will go into extremes. They would be willing to sacrifice themselves in what is known as suicide bombing, in order to kill as many of those whoever different or what, like just to do something in anger, because you lose your mind. If we want to put an end to this, first we have to put an end into supporting tyrannies, supporting killers and murderers. We have to put a stop in the militarism, in the interventions, in arming the wrong guys all the time. Why do they think problems are solved with arms? Problems cannot be solved with violence. Violence begets violence.
Right.
And everybody is suffering with this cycle. Who should stop it? Those who have supposedly the biggest strengths, because they should also show restraint. They should show maturity. They should show an ability to see the bigger picture. But this is not what is happening. State Department always, through my experience in my meetings at the State Department, they have the Cold War mentality of, we have to support our SOBs against their SOBs, whoever it is.
Right.
So, yeah, this
right.
is it.
And we will continue to arm them and profit from the from armament.
Well, again, I have the problem with the word we. The we is not they. They're doing this.
Right.
Saudi Arabia, we have Saudis in American planes, hardly using, dropping American bombs in Yemen.
In Yemen. Killing scores of civilians in Yemen. And that Wahhabi crazy government of Saudi Arabia, which is responsible anyway in giving terrorists a justification for using violence because of their Wahhabism, which is foreign to Muslims,
Wahhabism,
something that started less than 200 years ago.
Wahhabism, it comes out of the Sunni, so we have Sunnis and Shias killing one another. You mentioned the suicide bombings, suicide bombers going into a Shia mosque, because somehow they're killing themselves, making shrapnel out of their very bones, and tearing and killing people because they happen to be Shias rather than Sunnis, having to be born one way or another. That's they. And the State Department, as you said, is manipulating these folks. Most Americans don't even know the difference between a Shia and a Shui, and I'm a Shia and a Sina, what's happening. So, but the we that we're talking about is the people of the world who are not part of that. That's the we I'm talking about. Right. The we, like Sarah.
Like Sarah, yeah.
Like Sarah decided on her own to go to the Isle of Lesbos and to lend a hand with the refugees coming out of this situation. This very situation in Syria, there was once a pan-Arabism where Syria and Egypt and so on were one country. Now people are killing each other.
Yes, it was the United Arab Republic.
That's what we're about.
And the capital was in Cairo, yes.
That didn't last, in Cairo, that didn't last long. But Sarah, you've been with the refugees. You're hearing the refugees. They're coming in by whatever way. It's like a river. Not that they have choice, but they just want to get away from these bombs, these barrel bombs and all of this. Tell us what you hear and how you feel.
Well, I spent a lot of time. I spent the first 3 months on Lesbos. I spent the last 2 months I was gone in Izmir, really doing pretty close one-on-one work with an artist couple from Syria and filling myself in on what the situation really is, because you can't tell from reading the U.S. press. Even if you read the indie press, even if you read the entire world's press, you can't tell what's going on. There's just not enough getting out, and it's too conflicting. So I got it from the horse's mouth, and it's just like Ahmed said, and pretty much as I suspected. Assad is a dictator. The whole Arab world, since the fall of the Ottoman Empire and the carving up, the neocolonial carving up among the allied nations at one World War One. The entire situation, every Arab nation, most Muslim nations have been under this colonialism, but this which has been exacerbated in recent years, even with sort of technical autonomy or national aspirations met to some degree. The cultural hegemony, the financial hegemony, much of what's going on in the Middle East has been a reaction to that. And the flip side of the coin is the dictators, who like their power. They want to stay in power. They're being courted by the West to a degree that's firmly fixes them in that luxurious, powerful seat that they're not willing to give up for anything, and they go to farther and farther extremes to keep it. And so Assad is doing what Sisi is doing in Egypt, Assad is doing in Syria. And the imprisonments, the bombings, the assassinations, this is at the root cause of the refugee crisis. And the U.S. has a tremendous amount of blame on this particular score.
The U.S. has been arming various groups that they claim to be, like you said, like RSOBs, right? The good, yeah. They're all bad guys because they're fighting, but these guys are better, so we're going to arm these guys. But there's so many groups that this uprising in Syria created this big vacuum for militant groups to come through. And so I'm sure you've with your work with the refugees there have heard about just these people coming in who are not the people rising up and as initially kind of started this kind of conflictual situation and kind of throwing Syria into this kind of chaos.
Indeed, there are so many groups: the Daesh, the Jabhat al-Nusra, the IS, the so-called Islamic State. There's so many groups: the Free Syrian Army. And then the ramification of that with it's not just Syria and Egypt either. I mean, the whole Middle East is in flames. The U.S. has been continually bombing Iraq since 1991. And with the refugees, they're not just coming from Syria. They're coming from Syria. They're coming from Iraq. They're coming from Iran. They're coming from Pakistan and Afghanistan, Morocco, Sri Lanka, Senegal. They're coming from everywhere, so desperate. And the powers that be, in their infinite wisdom, are saying that places like Afghanistan and Pakistan are safe countries, so they're not really refugees, they're migrants, which is patently absurd. Obama's been bombing Pakistan for eight years continuously.
And if I may say something here, some people think if a land was bombed for a year or two and then it's no longer being bombed, it's safe. Big, big wrong. I'm sorry to say this. The bombing uses depleted uranium in order for the shells to have more piercing power and to be more hot and inflamed or whatever. And this depleted uranium is radioactive. And it is something that gets in everything where the bombing takes place. So the soil, the water, everything is harmful for any living being. Then you look at these countries that where they have been subjected to the bombing, and look at the infants who are coming with incredible deformities, those who are dying, and think of yourself. Would you live in those circumstances? Before you condemn the refugees, just think for a moment. If I were in their shoes, and my house was destroyed, and my city is in ruins, and it's all just poisonous, radioactive wasteland, should I continue to live under these circumstances? Would this be good for me and my children? If you think about this seriously, you would understand why people are sacrificing their lives in boats trying to save their children.
Yeah, the depleted uranium use is actually, it's a nuclear weapon. It's not an atomic bomb per se, but it is a nuclear weapon, and it's being used with impunity.
Well, we're using these horrible things. We're hearing horrifying things piled on. We're seeing a situation where you had mentioned what, a couple of weeks ago, that there are now 50,000, after the great joy and exultation of Tahrir Square, there are now 50,000 political prisoners in Egypt. Is that right?
Yeah.
This is happening through. So I want to ask you, Ahmed and Sarah, is there any, what can we do? We can talk about victims forever, and there are victims forever. But how can we build? What can we do, a voice, to build a community, to help bring the people together, to talk about the refugees, people from every, from all the Middle Eastern countries and beyond coming in, from Africa, from the Middle East? What are the spots in which people can organize, where we can find this Common Thread Collective radio show? So what I'd like to do right now is to ask how we can help encourage that common thread, how we can build a peace and love and understanding and intelligent response, a community, how we can build community in the face of all this and build a revolution of the people from the bottom up. What we can do as a small radio station right here, the Common Thread Collective.
Okay, there is a huge responsibility of those in power in the United States for their own people and for the rest of the world. Why? Because the United States is the biggest military force in the United States, and we all know the power of Wall Street in the world. So it's economic and military power. With this, of course, there is a huge political power. And we are having all these big problems domestically and abroad. So domestically, we see that the voice of the people is not really heard. Why? Because politicians have allegiance to their biggest contributors and not to their constituents.
Right.
And this has to be combated. So everybody has to vote, and to vote for the right candidate, not for who they are told to vote for. They have to think and see who can serve me better. That's a very important point.
Well, we had the rise, and brought a lot of hope to people. I'm talking about Bernie. I'm talking about Bernie Sanders, who got millions of votes, but in fact was kind of crushed by that very system you're talking about. But that movement is going to continue.
Yeah.
He was there because a movement is going on of the people, a movement of the people, more and more people realize both internationally and domestically, as you say, that there's got to be another way.
Right, and we had Democracy Spring back in April, where people marched from Philadelphia to Washington, D.C. for a week or more of nonviolent sit-ins and protests, and over 1,400 peaceful protesters were arrested. But then also, in the weeks following that, we saw that there were over 100 representatives who had then pushed forward some legislation about voting rights and getting money out of
none of
campaigns.
This can be achieved without the power of the people. As long as we keep pushing and we keep trying, we can get some of our rights.
Well,
once we stop, we will be abused by those in power.
It's about everybody lending a hand. Everybody brings what they have to bring. Nobody goes without. Guess what?
Well, I think.
Hey, let me get into it. I'm about to get into it. Guess what, people? Hey, Val, after the show, I got my pack. I got my little wheeled cart. I'm taking off across the country, spreading this message. Hey, Rain. I just got a text. Hey, Rain. I'm coming through on Sunday in Missoula, Minneapolis, the Rainbow Gathering, where we're going to get the people together, where I'm going to do what I do in the Green Mountains of Vermont. That happens to be Bernie country. We'll see what happens. And then we're going to be caravanning down. Hey, Felipe. I know you're listening with our kitchen buses, and we're going to be there in Philly. During the Democratic Convention, where we're going to be feeding the people. That's important. We talk about food for the body. We'll be helping do that. Mind and spirit in Philly. I'll be there during the Democratic Convention. I'm inviting all the Bernie delegates. First, Bernie, if you're listening, I'd like to do a Hugh manifesto. Asking all your delegates, people who have never been in the political process before, who are not Democrats, who are elected as Bernie delegates, to come to Philly for the convention. Come to Philly and join us. Come to Philly and lend a hand. I plan to be there. And Val, on the Friday that I'm there, I'm going to be doing a feed, what do you call it?
You're going to be our far-out, far-flung correspondent.
In Philly, and I'm inviting all the folks. In fact, I came up with the vision when I'm thinking about that this morning. The vision came to me of Occupy Philly. Occupy the nation. I believe that Occupy spirit is still here. We were Occupy San Francisco. We were a voice of that. I don't want to say the voice. During that period, 5 years ago, the Occupy spirit was that. And it's time for a revival, a resurrection, and a renaissance. So I'll see you in Philly. The gathering is in the Green Mountains. It's not far from Bennington College. From Bennington up in the hills. And that's the last week of June. The first week of July, and then come there, and then we're going to be caravanning down, hopefully picking up people along the way to Philly, to be in that square, being in that one of the historical city like Boston, out of which came American Revolution, where we bring that spirit. Hell yeah! So come on through. Hey, Ahmed, you're welcome. Hey, Sarah, come on through, and we'll be talking about all this. It's another step forward, and hey, guys, so glad to be here, and we be a voice of all that. So Ahmed.
I think Sarah was about to ask about
community and how we build that and how we build the common thread. And I really think that the most important thing that most people need to do, and certainly here in the U.S., is educate yourselves and educate others. Read, think. Look at the whole picture. Don't just pick out a little piece that you want to see.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, Dave, but I got to say it. I appreciate the popular support for Bernie and all that, but let's not forget, too, that this man did vote for unlimited war on Afghanistan.
Well, that's not why people voted for him. People voted for him for another vision. They had a vision. Whatever he did.
I know, but I'm saying
he's gone. We're going on way forward here, which is...
Let's look. Let's pay attention. Let's look at the whole picture. Let's educate ourselves. Let's go in armed with knowledge, because it's what we have. It's the only thing we have against their weapons, is our knowledge and our unity, and we have to work on that.
Hell yeah. Well, but I think the movement has gone on. Bernie played a role. Whatever he did there, he played a role. People had another image. And that was not an image. It had nothing to do with a limited war. That had to do with another image of peace, love, and understanding. And that's the image that we share. I think that's what's going out there. I think that's what we're going to be putting out. I know that's what we're going to be putting out in Philly when we occupy Philly. Before the convention, because we had a couple of weeks, I think we'll go down there slowly and then invite people to come through. And it'll be another bomb. And Bernie is behind us, whatever it is. I don't want to get into that at the moment. I felt the energy when I was in Oakland, and all the young kids said, Bernie, but they have another image. They're not that he had in a limited war, whatever he put it in there. He represents something else, but now we're going on. Did you hear me?
I hear you.
I'm not going to Philly, and I think we're not going to Philly, and we'll be careful about that, because we want to, Bernie's an old man, he let him retire. We're going on forward.
Cool.
At the
moment. I'm glad to hear.
Wonderful.
It. Can I say one more thing about the refugee crisis?
Please do. Please tell us more.
I would really like to say that although it's dropped out of the news quite a bit, you know, it's not a trending hashtag on Twitter anymore or anything like that. The crisis is actually worse now since the EU-Turkey deal that began implementation on March 20th. What's happened is they cleared out all the refugees from the camps and the islands to separate them because they were in a different category from those who arrive on March 20 or later, who are all in detention to be deported. And they put them in these government camps all over, scattered all over the mainland with absolutely no services, including no electricity and Wi-Fi, which, although it may not sound that important, maybe to somebody who takes these things for granted, is one, the only way these people have of keeping in touch with family members left behind or scattered elsewhere on the journey.
Right.
But also, those people are supposed to be able to apply for asylum in Greece now that the borders are closed, but the way that you are required to do that is through a Skype connection. And without internet and without electricity, keeping your Skype appointments going to be a little difficult. So the people have all, we're talking 40 to 50,000 people here, less those who are under detention because they come from so-called safe countries like the Pakistanis. These people have all filtered to Athens, where there's absolutely no support. So there's some volunteers working at the tent city set up in Piraeus at the port, and anarchists have set up squats, big squats, housing about 4,000 people, mostly families, but that still leaves like 30, 35,000 people on the streets with absolutely no support. No way to get a job, no bank account, no way to have money sent to them, no toilets, no showers, no places to sleep, no food, nothing. Absolutely no support whatsoever. And I heard reports, people I know, kids, underage, people are turning tricks, people are stealing, people are turning to hard drugs because they have absolutely nothing. This crisis is much worse than before. Mm-hmm. If Egypt joins in it, it's already so epic in sense of size. And if 100, you know, if Egyptian refugees join this, it's already completely unmanageable. This they need help. They need help. They need help desperately. And if you can volunteer, if you can go help set up a camp, help feed somebody, if you can send money, find a way, a reputable organization, they need help.
They are human beings who are facing, a real serious disaster that is
desperation.
On a level that I don't know if anybody can even say that they could actually understand fully, because when you are outside a conflict, it's never the same as when you step into it. Like when I was once in a tour zone part, which was actually the city of Rafah being under bombardment from the Israelis, the bombs that would explode even in a distance, they shake the ground so much that you can have trouble standing on it or keeping on it. And it's deafening and it's stunning in a traumatic way. Now imagine if this happens nearer, or it happens to your house, or you're fleeing a city that is being bombarded with even larger weapons like what I've seen with Syria, and all that. It's very painful to see shattered children cut in pieces, to see all the death and the blood firsthand, and then what if actually this was your brother? What if this was your sister or your mother?
And to come to the realization with Zagram is that we're all brothers and sisters on the planet.
Yeah.
And that's we're all brothers and sisters. That's the basis of the movement we have to build. Is people understand that and are ready to lend a hand. And so part of my lending hand is I'm taking off today. Val will be here, but I'll be taking off across the country. And so, Sarah, I want to ask you, as you find out, if you can, could you come? Val is going to be doing the show. And as you can find, both as you can find places to suggest of trustworthy community groups, trustworthy camps, trustworthy people to build a camp with, refugees we could connect with, who could be connected with, because we need a movement from the bottom up. We need a movement where the refugees themselves are participating in their own destiny and their own world.
Absolutely.
So that's the vision. That's a vision we all share. Sarah, could you, as you look into that, could you come back on a regular basis, maybe even a weekly basis, and let us let us know what you've discovered.
Oh, for sure.
Okay.
I'm in close touch with.
Well, let's do that. We're not the voice, but we're a voice of it. You can. I think you can see, having been around, you know what our point of view. We have no ideology, whatever it's called, but we have a spiritual, political view that people need to get together, and all the borders need to come down, and we're all fellow human beings on the planet. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely.
Say, do you agree with that, Sarah?
Absolutely.
Hell yeah.
Are you down with that, Val?
Oh, yeah.
Are you down with everybody?
Yeah.
So that's where we come from. So let's do it. So I want to thank you folks for coming. And anything we can bring, their voice, any music, anything we can play, any connections we can play, we can do all of that, can't we, Val?
Yes, we can.
If it's in the cloud, we can get it.
It's true.
If it's a phone call, we can get it. So let's, we're a voice of that. We're under the radar, which is a good thing. We look around, but we can be heard around the planet.
Yeah. I would like to also suggest to the listeners, if they haven't checked out my book, it's called You Are Under Arrest for Masterminding the Egyptian Revolution. My name is Ahmed Salah, AhmedSalah, and it's on Amazon. Please check it out, because I think, and many fellow activists who had read it and academics who had read it and gave their reviews, that the lessons learned from this experience can be helpful for activists in many different places. And I am really hoping that this experience, now being put in writing, can reach out to every person who has an interest in creating a change using nonviolence, using peaceful means, understanding where are we, how can we proceed, and what shouldn't we do? Like, through the experience, you will see all the different things that we have tried and we have failed, and why did we fail? So, to see how we can actually achieve a result, a valid result, we have to learn from the mistakes in order not to repeat them and just keep on repeating the same vicious circle that is not leading us to the next step. So I really suggest that people check it out on Amazon and see if it would be to their interest. Again, the name is You're Under Arrest for Masterminding the Egyptian Revolution.
Yeah, I can definitely recommend it. I started reading it. I'm just a little bit into it, maybe a couple chapters in. And it's a very accessible, it's very readable. It's a memoir. It's your memoir, Ahmed. But it weaves in not only the events of the Egyptian Revolution in 2011, but weaving in the history behind it, showing the integration of your own personal story and your family's personal story and how it all relates to all these historical events within Egypt. I was a political science major, so I had to read a lot of kind of dense things. This is not dense. There's a lot of information in there, but the way that it's told, you feel like you're kind of sitting there listening to Ahmed talk. It's something that anyone could really sink their teeth into and get a really good picture of the recent history. And when I talk about recent history, I'm talking about like the last century, but also the past few years. So I definitely recommend it.
Ahmed, I feel the spirit has brought you here. The spirit has brought you in a real way, and you can see what.